The Ball Year Round podcast is brought to you by Essential Coaching, allies in holistic coaching and educational program development. Essential Coaching aims to produce exponential generational change by creating the deepest connected coaching community in the world. Your pain points are real, coach, and Essential Coaching wants to help you feel more fulfilled and happier in your career. Join coaches and educators spanning three different continents for real, relevant, and necessary professional development. If you'd like more information about Essential Coaching, visit their website at www.essential-coaching.net. Again, that is www.essential-coaching.net. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to Ball Year Round Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Roshan, and our other host, Mike, is on a business trip in Denver. But today I'm excited to welcome John Spolstra to the show. John is a successful author, sports marketer, and former NBA executive for the Buffalo Braves, Portland Trail Blazers, Denver Nuggets, and back when they were the New Jersey Nets. He is the co-founder of SRO Partners LLC, a sports marketing and consulting firm. They work with the NBA, the NHL, MLB, and the minor leagues. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce the most innovative and successful sports marketers, John Spolstra. How are you doing today, John?
Hey, Andy. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking some time to come on with us. You know, we're really excited to have you and, you know, learn from your journey. I guess I want to start off with, after graduating from Notre Dame, says that you created your first marketing company called the New School of Youth and Phenomena. Would you be able to kind of talk a little bit about that for us?
I got into that when I realized that college newspapers collectively had a huge distribution. Mm-hmm. And that instead of putting an ad in college newspapers for a sponsor, what if we put in a poster? So like if you take an 8.5 by 11 sheet and unfold that twice, it would be 17 by 22, which becomes like a mini poster.
For sure.
So I went and talked to some national clients, and like one of them was one of them was with Pabst Beer. All they wanted was their label.
Okay.
But a 17 by 22 inch poster. So folded up, we put that into a million newspapers in college newspapers. And kids would take that, a certain percentage of them would take that and put it on their wall.
Okay.
So then that became sort of like a living billboard in that campus. And depending on how many kids liked the poster, depending on how many billboards were on that campus. Mm-hmm. And like one of them we had was a cropped photo of a woman from her chest down to a little bit below her navel. Mm-hmm. And there was a Falstaff beer. That Falstaff beer was in brewed in St. Louis at the time. Okay. And it said, there's a beer cap in her navel. And it said, great beer bellies are made, not born.
No.
But that one made it up on college walls all over the place.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, that's such a great story. I'm definitely going to go back and look for it. We were kind of talking before the show here, how you were able to obtain some rights to the Notre Dame basketball games. Would you be able to talk a little bit about that as well?
Well, while I had this company, the New School of Youth Marketing and Other Phenomena, I'm a graduate of Notre Dame, and I was living in Chicago, in Evanston.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get, the Notre Dame basketball games were televised locally in South Bend, but no place else. They had two games a year televised, and those were the games against UCLA, when they had Bill Walton and, you know, those great teams.
Yes.
So we were living in an apartment in Evanston, and there was an existing antenna up there, a big one. Mm-hmm. And I went up there, strung some wire to see if I could see the Notre Dame basketball games. And because Chicago was right across the Lake Michigan to South Bend.
Yes.
And there'd be times when I could get it just clear as anything. And then it would disappear.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking, if I'm going to all that length to want to watch Notre Dame basketball game, there's probably other people that want to see it too. And Notre Dame had a good team. They had Digger Phelps. They had Adrian Dantley. They had really a good team. So I went to see Moose Krause. I called him up on the phone. I said, I've got an idea I think you'd be interested in. And he said, well, next time you're in South Bend, stop by. I said, well, how about tomorrow?
I like it. Yep.
And he said, well, I can't do it tomorrow. How about the next day? I said, fine. So I didn't have a write-up. I didn't have anything at that time. Mm-hmm. And I started to really crystallize the idea then. And I thought, well, Chicago, originally the thought was just Chicago because there's so many Notre Dame fans there.
Right.
But then I thought, wait a minute, Detroit is a Notre Dame fan too, even though Michigan and Michigan State are there. And I thought, you know, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, the whole East Coast. Mm-hmm. So I wrote up a plan that we would go to 13, I think it was 13 markets. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we developed our own Notre Dame network. I went and pitched them. And 2 weeks later, I had the deal. I had a 10-year no-cut deal with Notre Dame. I was going to pay them $2,000 a game to show you how the economics of the world has changed. And once I got into it, I thought, you know, instead of going to 13 markets, what if we went national?
Yeah.
And by the way, I'd never been involved with television before, so
okay.
I probably asked myself some pretty stupid questions. Okay. Anyways, we went national. We were a rating success. And unfortunately, we were a financial failure after the first year. And that was the end of that. But I consider it to this day, that was my greatest success and my greatest failure, all in the same endeavor.
It's so cool. And it definitely could tell it was a great learning experience. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about, like, how did the pitch go? What was that like? Going into all those people, you know.
Well, I think it was basically what I've just said is that you know, there's a lot of Notre Dame fans out there.
Gotcha.
Notre Dame at that time was limited to two games on TV, and that was with TVS. That was an independent television network that associated with NBC.
Gotcha.
Notre Dame gave me the deal because I think I was the only one that asked.
Yes.
And the $2,000 was a pittance to Notre Dame, but they really wanted the coverage. They wanted for all their fans to be able to see the games.
Yes.
So they wanted for bigger reasons than just the $2,000 a game.
Mm-hmm.
So it took about a week. They tried to negotiate up, and I said, no, $2,000. That's what it's got to be. We've got to make money on this.
Yep.
And we didn't. We didn't think we were going to make money the first year. We thought we'd really cash in the second year, but we never got the chance on the second year. So.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I just wanted to ask just because of, like, I think a lot of people are afraid to ask sometimes, you know, but it's like, if you're able to put yourself out there, you never know what can happen. And
well, somebody asked me the other day about ideas that I've had.
Yeah.
They said, how do they come up with ideas?
Uh-huh.
And I said, the ideas are really relatively free. I mean, everybody that's taken a shower, mm-hmm. has come up with an idea when they've taken a shower.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay, but then it's taking that idea and remembering it. It's almost like a dream where you sort of forget your dream when you wake up. But if you're taking that shower, you come up with an idea, come out, write down something on it, and then you got to try.
Yeah.
Most people don't do the trying part, or they don't write it down.
Mm-hmm.
But then you got to write it down, and you got to I'm not saying write down a business plan for it. I'd say in one paragraph, write out what the idea was. My idea was I wanted to put Notre Dame on television in 13 markets, Notre Dame basketball.
Yep.
And then you just got to try. I tried it. I mean, how many people would have stopped and not called up Moose Krause, who was the athletic director at the time?
Very true. Yep.
And how many people would have, when he said, well, as a courtesy, he picked up the phone, and then as a courtesy, he said, well, stop by when you're in South Bend.
Right.
That's sort of a nice brush off, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
But I tried, I said, how about tomorrow?
I like that. Yeah, that's the best part of it. I really like that part.
So I think the trying is the important part. The idea, everybody has the ideas. Uh-huh. But people don't take it to that next step after that, most of the time.
Most definitely. No, I agree with that for sure. And I appreciate you explaining that, because I, you know, sometimes we forget, but the writing it down piece is huge. I know that that's what I do for lists, so I can remember where I'm going.
Well, here's one for you, Andy.
Yeah.
I've done this for almost my whole adult life.
Mm-hmm.
Is that I write down up to three things that I want to improve or initiate in the next 90 days. Now, improve or initiate it could be I want to start a new book within the next 90 days. It could be I want to improve my putting in golf within the next 90 days. But it's up to three things. It's not five or six. It's not 10 or 11. It's up to three. It could be just one. So then let's say if I want to improve my putting over the next 90 days, then I have to sit down and say, okay, how am I going to improve my putting?
For sure.
It's not just declaring how I want to improve it. Uh-huh. I've got to come up with a game plan.
Exactly.
And then I've got to write that game plan down. No, it's not lengthy. It's not 30 pages. It's a page. But I've been doing that for almost my whole adult life. And it just, I think what it does is it just keeps you thinking about things to initiate. Like things that I will write down for the next 90 days. I probably haven't thought about that much right now. But it'll sort of come up that I do it.
Okay. No, I wrote that down there. So I'm gonna kind of implement that for myself too. I think it's a great idea. I have here in 1977, you were hired by the Buffalo Braves as the VP of marketing. How did that come about? Like, would you be able to explain that a little bit? And share what happened.
That's sort of crazy. I used to be when I had the company, the New School.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be a season ticket holder with the Chicago Bulls.
Wow, cool.
And at that time, I think the seats behind, like four rows behind the bench, were like $9.
No kidding. Watch the nosebleeds in the United Center you get for like, they're way too overpriced now anyway.
So, right. So a guy who sat near me, was a guy named Norm Sanju. And he eventually became the president of the Buffalo Braves. He knew John Y. Brown.
Okay. Wow.
So now I had gone through the Notre Dame failure. Mm-hmm. And I was selling, at that time, I had a job with a syndicated company selling the children's shows to TV stations.
Okay.
I was just trying to survive after my failure.
Mm-hmm.
And after failures, you know, that's what you try to do is survive and get ready for another day.
Yes, sir, for sure.
But I did a lot of traveling, and I was traveling through upstate New York, calling on TV stations in Syracuse, Rochester, and then Buffalo, and I was going to fly home.
Okay.
So I called up Norm. He was a general manager of Buffalo. We had sort of talked at the Chicago Bulls games, you know, over a couple of years.
Right.
We had a cup of coffee, or maybe it was lunch. And I gave him a bunch of ideas about how to market the Buffalo Braves.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he said, how would you like to come to work for me? And I didn't like what I was doing for a living. I was surviving.
Mm-hmm.
We really enjoyed living in Chicago, but we also like to have good food on our table too. So it's been a challenge. So we took the job.
That's awesome. No, that's great. And you know what's crazy?
Again, there's the trying.
Yes, exactly. Now it's always willing to, you know, just make a move and trust your instinct. It's right. It's amazing, you know, and it's funny, John, I'm actually from the Chicago suburbs myself. I'm from like Mundelein. It's further north than Evanston, but I'm from that area as well. So when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the smallest world, I swear. You brought in, you know, you were kind of brought in to prevent the team from, you know, relocating a bit, and they ultimately did, but like, what did that experience do for you? And did that help?
Well, see, I was brought in to show you what a crack marketing man I am. I was brought in to save the Buffalo Braves for Buffalo.
Yeah.
And about 10 months later, they moved.
Mm-hmm.
And about 5 months in, I found that I was sort of like the advance man to find a place to move them.
Oh.
So the previous owner had, when he sold the team to John Y. Brown, who was really the founder of Kentucky Fried Chicken, and later became the governor of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this couldn't happen in today's sports, but the guy sold the team to John Y. Brown, and the day before, he sold his three best players to his competitors, like Bob McAdoo, who's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
He sold.
Oh, my goodness.
So the team was a shell. The fans were all angry. Mm-hmm. New owner comes in. And I investigated certain markets like San Diego, Dallas, Louisville. Mm-hmm. And Dallas was a grand slam success.
Yeah.
And we wanted, I recommended that to the Board of Governors.
Okay.
John White had me make that presentation to the Board of Governors because the NBA Board of Governors had to approve any move.
Yes. Okay.
San Diego at that time, which of course is flourishing now, but at that time it was really pretty much still a Navy town, and it didn't have a lot of white collar businesses, and that's critical for the NBA is white collar businesses.
Gotcha.
Okay. And Dallas, that's all they had was white collar businesses. Right. Yeah. Houston had a lot of the blue collar businesses, the oil refineries, and all that. Dallas had the big banks, the big insurance companies, key to season tickets.
Okay.
John Y wasn't quite sure whether to move the team, so he asked for an extension, which he got.
Okay.
And after that meeting, he asked me to stick around because he was meeting with a guy who owned the Boston Celtics.
Okay.
And they sat out on the veranda of this hotel for 2 days with me sitting down at the next table. I was sort of the expert in the booth for John Y. Brown.
Gotcha.
Okay. I'm trying to think of the guy's name. The guy that owned the Celtics at the time,
mm-hmm,
was a movie distributor who lived in Los Angeles. And he wanted a team that was closer to home. So he wanted to, what worked out is that he traded the rights to the Boston Celtics for the rights of the Buffalo Braves, which I find phenomenal. Bill Russell and Bill Sharman and Bob Cousy and all those great Celtic teams. Yeah. The rights to the Celtics was traded for the lowly Buffalo Braves. And this guy moved that Braves to San Diego and called them the San Diego Clippers.
Yes.
Wow. So the Clipper DNA is the Buffalo Braves.
That is an amazing story. I did not even know that at all.
So I was sort of fed up with the way that all that transpired, because I really felt that Buffalo got the short end of the stick on that. First of all, with the previous owner selling his stars. And
yeah.
So I thought, this is an industry I don't want to stay in. I felt the owners treated this thing like poker chips or toys even.
Yeah.
So I was looking to get out, and I got a call from Larry Weinberg, who was at that time the owner of the Portland Trailblazers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also the chairman of the Board of Governors. So he had seen my pitch for Dallas.
Okay.
And he asked me to come up and meet with him about Portland, joining Portland. Mm-hmm. And we met for a full day. Actually, we met in LA, Beverly Hills, where he lives.
Mm-hmm.
And talked about different ideas.
Gotcha.
And he said, and then he asked me to join the Portland Trailblazers, the VP marketing there. I was going to decline it. I was going to take a job in Houston. I'd been negotiating with the TV station there. which that TV station alone was so profitable, they ended up buying ABC Network.
Oh my goodness.
Cap Cities, of which ABC Network bought ESPN.
Right.
And Disney.
Oh my gosh.
When I took the Portland Trailblazers, because I just want, you know, I told my wife, I said, the Houston deal was a better paying job at the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't particularly like, Houston summers are really brutal.
Yes.
And I said, I'd sort of like to see if my ideas would work in the best case scenario where the fans really liked the team. Mm-hmm. Unlike Buffalo, where the fans were just pissed off that of what happened. And I said, I'd just like to see what would happen if working with a team where the fans liked the team, would my ideas really work? Of which, so that's why we went to Portland, and that's, where I still live.
Definitely. I love Portland. It's a beautiful city. My brother lived there for a couple of years. So, could you talk a little bit about your time there? And, you know, you guys had the record 814 sold out games.
Right.
Could you kind of talk about what went into that, some different strategies that you did that were, you know, iconic?
Well, first of all, in Portland, the thing that what I was brought in there for was not tickets. But interestingly, radio rights, this was one of the ideas I talked with Larry Weinberg. Mm-hmm. Portland Trailblazers at that time, this would be 1979, so we're talking about 40 some years ago. At that time, the radio rights, the Portland Trailblazers received $25,000 a year from a radio station for the rights for that station to broadcast the games. That was third best in the NBA at the time.
Oh my God.
So it shows you how the economies have changed. Mm-hmm. Half the teams didn't receive anything from a radio station. They considered it just public relations.
Wow.
And I had told Larry that I felt that they should have made a lot more money than that. They had won the championship 2 years before, extremely popular. So I said, and I explained to him about the concept of bringing it in-house. There wasn't the phrase in-house at that time. No, none of the teams in any of the pro sports teams did on their own mm-hmm. for profit. And we said, first year we brought it in-house. I felt some resistance from the president of the team, but we brought it in-house, and that meant that we had to give up. We no longer could get that $25,000 rights fee, right? Because we were bringing it in-house. We had to pay for me, we had to pay for announcers, we had to pay for long lines, we had to pay for everything. And that first year, instead of making $25,000, we made $900,000.
Yeah, okay, so that was the right move.
But the thing is, you know, it's not that the radio station didn't, in the past, didn't know what to do. We just had more tools available to us that we could do promotions with the team. But that was a shot heard around the world in the NBA. I mean, we were making more money in little Portland, Oregon mm-hmm. than the rest of the NBA combined.
Jeez. Wow.
So other teams started to look into that. And that's how I got traded to the Indiana Pacers.
Yeah, I saw that.
Because they wanted to hire me as a consultant to show them how to do radio in-house. Mm-hmm. And Larry Weinberg, the owner, said no.
Yeah.
Well, shortly thereafter, like a week later, our starting point guard, Darnell Valentine, mm-hmm. out of Kansas, broke his wrist.
Okay.
And we needed another point guard. Well, the president of the Indiana Pacers, who had called up Larry Weinberg and said, I will trade you our starting point guard.
Starting point
guard. Don Boosie, who was all defense for three straight years in the ABA.
Yes.
For 2 weeks' time of John Spoelstra. And the owner said, sure.
Easily. Wow.
So I went to Indiana. Don Boosie came to Portland. Boosie stayed. He was a free agent at the end of the year, so he went someplace else.
Gotcha.
But he got us through that era where we were short at point guard. Mm-hmm. And I showed Indiana how to bring radio in-house.
Wow. That's a cool story. Again, like I was always wondering because I had saw a video where it mentioned that you were traded for a player, and I was just like, "How does this work?" But Okay, now I definitely understand. I was listening to.
I think Indiana got the better part of the deal too.
Ah, wait, 100% way better part of the deal. Are you kidding me? It had to change everything for them. So I was listening in an interview that you were on, and you had mentioned your the time that you would spend with your father, and that you guys had a special bond, and you always had time to talk. Would you be able to explain that? You said you took Eric to games and used that as that time. Talk a little bit
about that. My dad was a sports writer in Detroit covering the Tigers.
Yeah.
And so that was the one, I think with father and son, father and daughter, but the one thing you have to have with kids is something that you could safely talk about.
Yeah.
And with my dad and with me, it was the Detroit Tigers. Mm-hmm. So from the time I was young enough or old enough to understand that there was professional baseball and the Tigers to his deathbed when he died at 89 years old. We could always talk about the Tigers.
Yeah.
And with Eric, I coached him in the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade.
Okay.
So the link was basketball. But we'd go to Blazer games. And one year, probably when he was in the 8th grade, he probably went to every home game.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, it was easier to get around in those days. There was less traffic. So I'd come home from work. We'd have dinner. Then we'd head off to the game. And the games took less time then.
Okay.
You know, the games back in the 80s took 2 hours. Now they take 2.5 hours.
Facts. Okay, yeah.
I mean, the playing time is the same. They've just added, longer timeouts, more timeouts, so forth. So he probably saw every game, but this was the one point that, you know, we could talk basketball together.
Very nice.
And I thought that was the bridge that was important for a father and a son, that we had to have something. Mm-hmm. And even to this day, you know, we can talk about basketball.
Yep. Absolutely. No, that's great because I know that a lot of people that are busy, it's hard, you know, to find that time. But if you have, you know, like you said, that safe spot where you can talk about, you know, the common interest,
right.
It goes such a long way. Then, yeah, John, as, you know, kind of after that experience with the Blazers, you were briefly, you know, hired with the Nets, or I'm sorry, the Nuggets, but then kind of transitioned back to Portland and co-founded the SRO partnership. What came about with that? How did that transition happen?
Well, I went to the Nuggets on a 5-year no-cut contract, being president and general manager, and I was fired 91 days into that contract. To this day, Andy, I don't know why I was fired.
Gotcha. Okay.
But when they fired me, they said, don't worry, we'll honor your contract. And I had a 5-year no cut. And I was, at the time, I was one of the highest paid guys in the league. Mm-hmm. So I came back, I taught college at University of Portland. There was an offset, meaning if I went to work for another NBA team, they could deduct what I made from that NBA team from what they had to pay me.
Gotcha.
But I did get calls from other teams to consult. So that's really how it started. And then when I'm teaching class, I taught sports marketing at University of Portland. To make a point, I would always use the New Jersey Nets as how not to do things.
Okay.
I mean, I can't remember all the one-liners I had, but I said, the only thing the Nets led the league in was drug rehab cases.
Oh, damn.
just to try to keep the class a little bit lively. But I would continually make fun of the Nets as the counterpoint of how to do things.
Gotcha.
So, between Christmas and New Year's of that year, on a Sunday night, I'll never forget this, and it was like 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. Mm-hmm. I get a phone call. I pick up the phone. Now, who calls 10 o'clock on a Sunday night?
Exactly.
And this is before cell phones where you can see who's calling or so forth. This is just a regular phone.
Yep.
Younger people might not know what that is.
Might not.
So I picked up the phone, and the guy said, this is Alan Ofsian. I'm the chairman of the New Jersey Nets.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, sometimes you have like a micro thought where you can think of like a gazillion things in just a microsecond. Mm-hmm. You're thinking, kids in my class have got some adult to call up.
Yeah,
you thought of ripped me for making fun of the New Jersey Nets.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, what, you're looking for a drug rehab center for your players? But I didn't say that. I was going to.
Yep.
I thought it was a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we'd like you to come out and meet with us to tell us what to do on sponsorships.
Okay.
But I didn't want to go out to New Jersey. I mean, on a consulting thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was really glad. Just first of all, I was getting paid by Denver. That was cool.
Yes.
And I was doing college. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, and he said, we'll pay your fee, whatever it is. So instead of just turning him down, I said, I gave him a figure mm-hmm. that I thought was crazy.
Yep.
And he said immediately, okay.
Oh, wow. Didn't work exactly how you
And I said, but first class, too. First class travel.
Yes, for sure.
So I went there the week after New Year's.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember meeting with the seven owners. They were called the Secaucus Seven. Mm-hmm. And I said, you don't have a sponsorship problem. You have an attendance problem. Nobody goes to the games.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the game the night before when I got in, and I said, the people that are at the game, they look like suspects. They don't look like fans.
I hear that.
So I used some of those things in that meeting with the owners. So, so I said, you guys sell tickets.
Yeah.
Okay. And one of the owners said, well, who in the world would want to buy tickets? I said, therein lies your problem. And I agreed to consult and work with them on tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I looked at it, the bizarre thing was for that time is that, and this, I again met with the seven owners, who all seven were delightful guys individually.
Mm-hmm.
Collectively, it became a lot different. Gotcha. I mean, they would fight about the most obscure things. But mm-hmm. individually, if you went out with a guy individually, you say, that guy is really a terrific guy, mm-hmm. which they are. But anyways, one of the things I recommended was I said, let's disavow selling season tickets. Because
okay.
season tickets is the lifeblood of every team.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you got a crappy team. You've got a crappy history. Who in the world is going to buy season tickets?
Right.
And they only had sold like 1,500 that season. So, and they sat and they were in a building of 20,000.
Jeez. Okay.
So, and Andy, what I was doing, I wasn't working for that particular season. I was working for the season coming up. So I started in like March or April.
Okay.
It took us that long to finally agree.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, let's reverse this. Instead of trying to sell season tickets and selling the same amount of tickets for every game on up, let's try to get a sellout first. I said, you guys haven't had a sellout in 7 years. And you've had the Boston Celtics come here twice a year with Larry Bird, Kevin McHale.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't had a sellout with three times a year, you get the Knicks. Pat Riley was the coach and they had Patrick Ewing. Mm-hmm. You haven't had a sellout with the Lakers coming in with Magic Johnson. So I said, let's sell the games that the fans would most likely want to go to, not the games like Sacramento or Portland, who, you know, people in New Jersey don't even know that there is a Sacramento.
Right. You know?
So they didn't like the idea at first, but then they, in fact, one of the owners said he was so angry that when he got home that night, he walked around the block to walk off his anger.
Yeah.
That I would recommend to turn your back on season tickets and sell five game plans. He walked around the block again the second time, he said, and the third time he thought, maybe this is a touch of brilliance, let's try it. Well, we had a crappy team, still the worst in the league, and we sold out, we sold those five game plans, we sold 25,000 of them.
Wow.
And it rolled over into other games. Mm-hmm. So we sold out five games. So for those five games, the people went to those games.
Yes. Wow.
They had a good time.
Yeah.
They saw a great game. Our players were pumped. They usually played pretty well. Mm-hmm. And for the, and I said to the owners, I said, for the games that you got crappy attendance, you don't worry about it because the games weren't on TV. And if nobody goes to the game, nobody knows that nobody went to the game.
Right. Wow. Man, that's such a great strategy.
So the next year, we kept on that strategy. Then I think I joined them as president.
Yep.
Because we had a bunch of young guys, hired a bunch of young guys who are now, doing really well in the sports industry. And that year we went, I think it was from 5 sellouts to 12 with a crappy team. And then I think we went to 19, then we went to 31. No, so we were working our way up. And for the Sacramento game, which Sacramento at that time was a crummy team, but they also didn't have any knowledge, our fans didn't have any knowledge of Sacramento. We cut a deal with White Castle. And before I got there, every game they had a discount. That so the 41 home games are 41 discounts. Okay. Eliminate all the discounts. One of our guys came in, the VP came in office and said, "You sure you want to eliminate them all?" I said, "Yeah, we're going to eliminate them all." I said, "We're going to come back with some, but we want to funnel all the people that want to go to a discounted game to one game."
Oh, okay.
One game per month.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So if you're a family, you want to go to a Nets game, but we're going to make this deal an unbelievable deal. Mm-hmm. Wow. And I think, Andy, I think the original deal was tickets for four. Mm-hmm. You get tickets for four, you get two gifts. You get a basketball and a cap.
Okay.
And you get four meals at White Castle. All four, I think it was $39.
Jeez, oh, man, it's a heck of a deal.
But we won. This was a different way of trying to get a sellout. Mm-hmm. And we did one of these games per month. So we didn't do it every game. Mm-hmm. We sold out every game.
Yeah. Wow.
And we made money off of it because even at $39, we did make some money. We made more money than if we had the game and nobody showed up.
Exactly.
So we made some money, and it gave us five extra sellouts a year. After I left, my successor thought this thing worked so well, he would do it for 21 games. Mm. Well, then it's lost its, and instead of $39, why don't we charge $79? Well, it lost its magic, and then they discontinued it the following year or 2 years after that.
Right. Yeah, no, but that's like, and I'm guessing too, like not many teams, like the teams that struggled, nobody else was really implementing that. Did you and your team, like, how did you guys come about? Like, was it about testing it or like,
no,
it was just go and see what happened.
No, I think we'd sit around and sort of beat ourselves up on the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But if we thought it was a good idea, we went with it.
Yeah. Okay. Like that. No, that's perfect. And, you know, it obviously worked. And I'm taking all
the trick on this. And I wrote about this in my book, How to Get Your Ideas Approved or Get Your Ideas Approved.
Mm-hmm.
The trick on all this stuff that I did, like bringing radio in house or, the White Castle games, wasn't the idea. It was get the owner to approve it.
Yeah. True.
Exactly. So I had a system where I really think my success in my career shouldn't be attributed to the ideas that I've had, mm-hmm. but should be attributed that I got the owners to approve it.
Yes.
And then allowed me to go ahead and do it. And I've got a formula, which I put in the book. I'm not trying to sell the book because the book sells for, I think, $2.99. So it's not like mm-hmm. I'm making a fortune off of it, but I wrote How to Get Your Ideas Approved.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. No. Perfect. Now that's because like that was a question that I had. It was like, how does that, that negotiation process go? And, with how you're pitching it to these people to show the value and to get them to say yes. You know, I think it's the hardest thing.
Well, that's the thing. In fact, I only utilized that when I probably 12 or 13 times in my career.
Okay.
But they were all turned out to be really big ideas that were changing, that changed the industry.
Absolutely. And John, it said you're most famous for like one of these campaigns in 94 with the rubber chickens and they that you sent to the season ticket holders that hadn't bought tickets yet. And it read, don't foul out. Would you be able to talk about how that kind of came about? And
well, here's the rubber chicken.
Nice. Okay.
Looks like.
Yeah.
This was in New Jersey and my first year as president. And the season ticket holders had gotten used to where they didn't have to renew on a certain deadline. They could wait till opening day before, and they'd have their seats reserved and everything. But that stopped us from selling those seats if they weren't going to renew.
Okay.
So I wanted to know, are you going to renew or not? I said to our VP, I said, I'm going to send out a registered letter asking them, are you going to renew or not? And he said, well, it won't do any good. I said, why not? He said, well, they won't open it. I said, a registered letter? He said, no, we've tried that before. They know what you're doing. They're going to wait and see what the team is like. And then maybe even the second or third game, they'll say, okay, here's my check. I want my seats.
Gotcha. Okay.
Very same seats. But that really hurt us in selling tickets and placing people.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually choice seats.
Yep.
So I said, you can't get them to open it up. I said, you want to make a bet? And I just received this a few days before, this rubber chicken.
Yeah.
And I said, I bet I can get them to open up my letter. And I said, we're going to take this rubber chicken.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put a little paper jersey on it. It says, don't fall out, F-O-W-L.
Yep.
Read the letter. And attached to the rubber chicken's foot would be a letter. And the letter was from me.
Yeah.
And I explained to them in, you know, not business-like terms. I'm just sort of like I'm talking to them why I needed to know. Are you going to renew or not? And by the way, if you choose not to answer me one way or the other, I'm assuming that that means you're not going to renew. And I'm going to sell your seat locations to somebody else by 3 days from now.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Oh, and I put this, Andy, I put the chicken in one of those triangular 3-foot FedEx boxes.
Okay.
So let's say you're a reluctant season ticket holder. You're not making a decision. But you receive from the New Jersey Nets this box, 3 feet long, triangular, from the New Jersey Nets.
Yeah.
Are you not going to open it?
I have to.
You open it up and you pull out this rubber chicken. You're wondering, what the hell is this? Right?
Oh, man.
And it says on the jersey, read the letter. Don't fall out, read the letter. What are your chances that you would not read the letter?
Honestly, I would say it has to be negative one. Like, you have to read the thing.
You have to read the letter.
Gotta know.
And we got about 100% response.
Wow.
All of them did renew. I got phone calls from countless season ticket holders that had sent. We'd sent this to about 50 accounts, which is sort of expensive, you know, because the chicken probably costs $3 in a box and so forth. It might be $15 per, but at least you get to know.
Right.
Wow. And I got a humorous one. I got a call from in northern New Jersey. It's really a diverse area. They've got a lot of Indian doctors, India doctors.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I got a call from this one guy, and he said, why did you send me a dead duck? So I guess the rubber chicken thing doesn't translate over to India.
Yeah. Oh, no.
I tried to explain to him that it was sort of fun. It was, you know.
Yeah.
He renewed.
Awesome. No, that's such a cool idea. I remember I saw the video and I was like, no way. And that's what kind of really turned me on to be like, I have to find out. I have to ask this man what this was and how he did it. So now that's such a cool story. And definitely something I would try to use if I were to market. John, would you be able to share, you're a three-time author. Could you share about, you know, you said your most successful book was Success is Just One Wish Away. Would you be able to talk a little bit about that?
I've reissued it next quarter.
Okay.
But that one's where I come up with three ideas that I want to initiate.
Okay.
And I write about it, but I put it into a business fable. My most successful book was really Marketing Outrageously, because that made the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. And Ice to the Eskimos was my first one. And that was really about the New Jersey experience. And then I've written two novels, which are still selling well on Amazon. Another one's going to be launched again in the first quarter. That's a novel, Who's Killing All My Old Girlfriends?
What's that about? Interesting title.
Mystery.
For sure. Okay. What's the, what was the first book's name? The novel that you had mentioned, you didn't mention the name of that book.
Well, the first one was Red Chaser, about the, that's about the 1950s and the era of McCarthyism. And in the backdrop is the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 1951 pennant race, which is probably the best pennant race in the history of baseball. The second one was Do-Overs, which is a time travel novel. And that's still selling very good. Every, like on Amazon, Amazon sells like 13 million books. Do-Overs ranks in the top 20,000.
Oh my gosh.
All the time.
Very nice. Awesome.
And that's time travel. That's a novel. It's a fun book.
Yeah, no, I just want our listeners to be able to go and find those if they'd like to. I definitely know I want to, you know, buy one of these books. I need to read up more because your advice has been phenomenal. John, you know, before we kind of wrap up, would you be able to tell us a little bit about what you're doing today and any projects you're working on?
I would say I'm fully retired, but that's in the means of not doing consulting work for teams. Steve DeLay, who I originally hired at the New Jersey Nets years ago when he was a young guy, right out of college. And then I hired him at when I was at 11 years at Mandalay. He and I formed a business afterwards where we owned a summer league bat league baseball. I've sold my holdings to him, and he's doing a terrific job. And he's got two teams now. So I'm writing. I wrote, co-wrote, or an older friend of mine who's 85. He wanted to write a book for his grandkids. He's a former coach, so I helped him write that. And then I've written one novel, and I'm finishing about two-thirds of the second one, the sequel.
Very nice.
Okay. So I'm going to break both of the novel and its sequel at the same time. Interesting. So if you like the first one, click buy the second one.
For sure. Definitely. No, looking forward to those coming out. And sorry.
And I play golf 100 times a year.
Love that. Love that. What do you shoot?
Usually 85.
Okay, dang. You would kick my butt. But I'm down here in Florida, and I love to go golfing when I have the time. So if you're ever around, let's go shoot around.
Hey, where are you in Florida?
I'm in Orlando, just outside a little bit. So, yeah, we're by Disney a little. So, but, yeah, anytime. John, real, just, you know, before we kind of go, I just want to tell you thanks so much. Is there anywhere that our listeners can find you online, or is it mainly just the books? Is there anywhere?
I put my email address in my books. So if they want my email address, they can contact me. I usually, well, just like with you, I got back to you. And they should buy, actually, if it's a person that's got ideas and needs, that's got a boss that's sort of a jerk or lazy and needs to get it approved, they should spend $2.99 and get your ideas approved.
Facts. I'm buying that today. Believe me, I got a few ideas that I need to go to the people and get them approved. So I need a strategy. So,
you know, Andy, I found out that if you follow what I say in that book, and I found out that there's some things that are really unfair in life. Mm-hmm. And that's unfair to the person you're pitching the idea to. They have no chance of saying no.
Yeah.
I've got this approval on every time I've used this system. 12, I think it was 13 times. So it's 13 out of 13. There hasn't been a time that I didn't get the approval. And I got approval from people that didn't want to give me the approval.
Yes.
And I got approval from people that didn't like me. But they had to approve it. And but that's what my success was. It wasn't, like I said, the idea so much. It was that I got the thing approved and then was able to make the idea work.
Yes. No, that's perfect. And I'm definitely going to work to implement that, and I'll let you know how it goes. I'm hoping that definitely. I can keep the streak alive. All right, John. Well, hey, I really appreciate you coming on today. I don't want to take up too much of your time, okay. You know, sharing with us, and I hope we can stay in contact. You know, it would be great. Like I said, if you're ever in Orlando, you know, I'm always around.
Okay. Good talking to you, Andy. You got my email address and you got my phone number.
Yes, sir. I do.
Thanks. Keep the lines open. I will.
Will do. Take care, sir. I'll see you later.
Okay. Thanks.